Great. Okay, so this is Q&A call number 8 for SPSM 18.0. Thank you for being here. And I've got Jen here helping out and Susan. Thank you both for being here, helping out in the chat. And before we get started with this call, I wanted to just clarify something from the last Q&A call because there had been a couple comments I received sort of misunderstanding what I was saying. So I want to make sure it's clear. So this is in reference to boundary setting and the healthy aggression work, the annihilation work. I had been talking about on the last call about sometimes we, if we have relationships as adults with our parents and the parents are still abusive or behaving in ways that are toxic or unhealthy to us, we may have to put up a boundary. For a while at least, and not have contact with them so that we can heal the past stuff. And this isn't just true of parents. So, to be clear, this is true of anyone in her life who the relationship takes a toll on us. It's in some way that we could potentially avoid. Casual relationships, friends, former romantic partners, current romantic partners, parents, colleagues. I mean, there could be any number of people who are in our life in a way that causes us continual stress or frequent stress and strain. And if we're in the process of working through survival energy, we often may want to have boundaries with people who put us into more survival energy, because we're trying to unearth the stuff from the past, and if we have constant stuff coming in the present, that can make it a lot harder. So that doesn't mean, to be clear, that you must like separate from your parents in order to do this work. That was one of the misunderstandings. It's like, no, if you have a good relationship with your parents or anybody, great. Like that's fine. We don't have to have that kind of boundary with people who are a positive influence in our life or a neutral, influence in our life. Like it's not a rule, that you must differentiate in this way and have these boundaries. It's just only with people with whom there is this continual stress and strain on our system. So just want to clarify that. And also someone had asked like about the annihilation work, like, I just don't feel that, towards my parents. So is there something wrong? It's like, no, not necessarily. It's just might not be there. I mean, the healthy aggression and the annihilation work isn't there so that you go looking for it and try to make it happen. It's there so that if you do feel a ton of anger or sadistic urge, this desire to kill, so that you have something to do with that energy that's healthy. If it arises organically. So that's the other point I just wanted to make clear. Like, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be there. Not everyone will have that. It's just something that does frequently happen, especially if we've been overtly abused in our life. So just a couple points of clarification there, and I hope that is all making sense. So, common theme for this call. We had a few different questions about sexual abuse and different things that can happen as a result of that. So I wanted to put those all together in this first section since they were all kind of related. So the first one, it was quite interesting. Like it was a question about like, what if we had an early sexual experience that was actually, I mean, kind of innocent? This is something that happens between young kids, can happen. Like in this case, it was a memory of being three, and that there was a couple boys who were just a little bit older than her, and they had touched her genitals when they were all sharing a bath, and she doesn't have any, like she said she didn't have any aggressive memories around it, like it didn't seem problematic, but her mom completely freaked out at the time, and she feels tons of shame because of her mom's reaction, like it was this huge problem. Right. And so to be clear, like, yeah, sometimes young kids engage in touching and exploring each other's genitals in a way that like isn't abuse. It's like a natural kind of curiosity, like, hey, what do you got going down there? That's different than mine, and that's not necessarily a problem. But if the parent like then sees that and she reacts to it or he reacts to it as if it's a major problem, that can create some issues and like couple shame with sexuality. So in this case, yeah, you don't have to go looking for a problem that may not be there. It sounds like you're aware that there was this imprint of shame that got coupled with sexuality that came from your mother. And in that case, it's just about working with that shame imprint itself. And we've talked about that some in the past. Oftentimes, when we're working with shame, we sort of allow ourselves to feel it. We may allow ourselves to feel the posture of it a little bit, and then sort of feel what it's like to come out of that posture, feel that transition, that ability to move in different ways in and out, from that place of collapse into a place of more potency. The affect of disgust, of bleh, like get that out of me. I don't like that shame feeling. Just bleh, bleh. Like sometimes that is quite useful in purging, because these feelings of shame can often be in the gut. They can have this feeling, oh, like just sort of a sick feeling. And there can be sort of this energetic vomit that wants to happen. And that's totally okay to allow that to happen. And sometimes that will bridge naturally into aggression as well. Like, that was really wrong, Mom, that you did that. Like, there was no problem until you made it a problem. And so, like, now I've got this imprint for life. Thanks a lot. Blah, right? So there may be some self-protectiveness that wants to come out. And also, it may or may not be helpful to, on the flip side, have compassion for your mom. I don't know if that'll be helpful or not, but she was having a natural protective response, maybe overprotective. Maybe there's something in her history that she got triggered, but she was acting from a place of wanting to protect you. And I don't know if that'll be helpful or not at this point, but it's just something to mention. So another question was, what about if we've been through sexual trauma and it's resulted in a lot of bracing in the body, which is very common, numbness, inability to connect with and feel stuff going on in the lower abdomen? What do we do then? How do we work with that? So they had said in this question that cultivating the inhale and the exhale is really helping them to touch into feelings of within the chest and the ability to breathe. So, yep, keep doing that. Great. Also, the VOO and the VOO-AH lessons, getting really familiar with those sounds and projecting with those sounds that involve breath can be helpful. The VOO really kind of starts in the gut. It's this VOO, it's low, it's down here in the belly. And it's a way to start vibrating something down in that territory. So even if you don't feel anything at first when you do it, just practicing with that. And then that starts to bring the sound up into the throat, up into the jaw. So there's some movement that happens with when you do the VOO ah and that vibration. So those may be helpful. Also, the lesson gut brain awareness and intentions. That one is a more gentle kind of approach and may be useful in just bringing safety and connection. The layers lesson as well, connecting to different layers of the viscera, the bone, the fascia, the organs, the blood, the skin, just feeling into how you can bring that gentle listening kind of touch. And then the last thing that may be useful is working with a ball, working with an exercise ball. Now, this provides direct contact to the pelvic floor, so it can be activating. So you want to titrate your explorations with this. But it's just one of these guys here, big blue exercise ball. And essentially, you just sit on it. You want to be deflated enough that you can sit. I'm gonna move my camera so you can see. Oh, that's too low. Hold on. There we go. So yeah, you can see it's pretty deflated. So I'm really sturdy, right? Like my knees are pretty flat. I'm not sort of trying to keep balance. I can sort of sink into the ball here. And then it's just a matter of I'm just sitting and I'm just intending that my pelvic floor soften. Because this ball is bringing very direct contact into that whole region. And maybe like I'll explore some gentle sort of movement back and forth, left and right. Maybe I'll do little circles. Pause. Think about noticing the jaw. Is the jaw holding as we start to explore moving the hips in this way? And just seeing if you can allow everything to really sink and soften into the ball. That's the general approach. And what can happen as a result of that is that we start to get some energy moving up the spine a lot of the times. It can awaken some of the sexual energy that may be frozen or stuck. And it can really work to help us get in contact with that area of our body in a way that is pretty non-invasive. It's pretty safe feeling. But it is also a lot of direct contact. So just be aware if you try that out, like maybe you try it for a little bit, see how you feel. If you start to feel like a little bit like, oh, this is a little feel a little scared or I feel a little overwhelmed, then just feel free to leave it. Resource, contain, come back to it later, that kind of thing. And then another question around sexual abuse, and this is quite a complex one, is what happens, what do you do, rather, when, as a result of often this is, happens with sustained sexual abuse with a family member or a family friend, or it's something that goes on, what can happen is you can have this experience where the feelings of like yuck, gross, this is bad, this is wrong, gets intertwined with this is pl actually pleasurable, this is physically pleasurable and exciting also. And that can be really painful and confusing to have those things all mixed together and both feeling true. So they asked how to work with this somatically. There's other ways to work with this, probably through a psychological lens, I would imagine, which is not my expertise. But in terms of somatic work, I think the first thing we'd want to try to do is disentangle, sort of disentangle these experiences. So what is the bad, gross, yuck, painful, like what is that feeling like? Where does that live? And it may be that as you feel that, you're also feeling like this excitement or this feeling of pleasure. And it's like, can you just sort of focus on one or the other for a period of time and see if you can determine like, what is it? Where is it? How is it? Like, okay, so the yucky stuff, it's like, I'm just making stuff up here, but like, yeah, there's like this yucky feeling like a black ball in my gut and solar plexus. And my, yeah, I feel really heavy and like there's a little disgust. Like, see if you can narrow, sort of get specific, narrow in on like what actually is happening with those and what is happening with the pleasurable, exciting feeling. Like, how is that different? Where is that? If you can start to get clear about in your body the different nature of these feelings and really develop your ability to notice one and then notice the other, that may help to start to tease these things apart. And then expression, like how might that yuck, gross, painful, bad, ew, like how might that want to move through the body? How might the pleasurable, exciting feeling be noticed but not necessarily acted on? Right? There may be a level of restraint around actual sexual activity that would be helpful for a period of time as we work with disentangling these things, which means if you feel that pleasurable, exciting feeling, you may not necessarily want to act on it right away, but rather simply feel it. Like, oh, where is that? What is that? What is there a way to sort of move that energy in a non-sexual way? And finally, I think the piece that was really missing, of course, in this early experience of early sexual abuse is safe connection, intimacy, really being open with your emotions and vulnerability with another person. Like, all of that wouldn't really be able to happen in such a paradigm. And so it may be that you need to find ways to cultivate that with your partner. I believe you said you had a partner, but if not, finding ways to cultivate that within yourself, with your friends. Again, it may be sort of putting a break on actual sexual activity for a while and like feeling how the heart and the emotions can be available in an intimate context, which may mean like you're sort of maybe you're moving towards sexual activity, but then let's put a pause on this and just feel what it's like to be connected. Because that might open up a whole nother layer of emotions that may need to get out, may be expressed and felt. So, okay. So, individual questions here. How do you work with different traumas that blend together as one? How they blend together is complex and hard to explain. Could you address it in general? So, what you're talking about here is something we call the trauma vortex. So, we go through something that's overwhelming early in life. And very often, when that, of course, doesn't get addressed early on, we will tend to have similar experiences as we go through our life into adulthood. And what can happen is, even if they may not look similar on the surface, sometimes these traumas, traumatic events, get coupled together in association because they often will share some kind of theme. So, for example, if we have an experience of helplessness as a young person, any experience that involves helplessness may get sort of sucked into that trauma vortex. Now, of course, the beauty of the somatic work is that the trauma is in the physiology. It's not in the event fundamentally. So you don't have to worry about teasing apart the events. You just focus on working with what is present in the body from moment to moment. So you don't really have to worry about how do I separate these things that seem stuck together. You work with what's available from moment to moment as it arises in the body. It's not necessarily important to know this sensation or energetic experience is related to this experience, and this sensation is related to that experience. If that kind of clarity comes to you organically, great, that can be really beautiful and helpful, but you don't need to go looking for it. You can just work with what is present in the physiology from moment to moment. So, for example, say I had an experience where I was helpless as a kid because some older bullies were picking on me and there was nothing I could do because they were bigger than me. And then I'm in an airplane. And there's massive turbulence, and there's nothing I can do about it. Like those events look very different, but they're both experiences of being helpless and where things are out of my control. Those could easily get coupled together. I actually wrote an experience, wrote an article about this. It was actually about the connections that I found in myself between being in an incubator as a baby and being in really bad turbulence on a plane. And it's called Planes, Babes, and Incubators: Exploring Coupling Dynamics. So that's on my website. And Susan, if you can grab that and link it, that would be fantastic. So yeah, that's kind of how the trauma vortex works. It tends to suck in associated stuff. And again, you just work with what's present from moment to moment. What generally will happen if you do that, or what can happen, is that you will start to get clarity on your own organically. Like, oh, now I realize I'm feeling this about this. Okay. Oh, but oh, wow, I also see how that applies to this. And you want to just allow these revelations to come to you. You don't have to go looking for them. Okay. In many lessons, we are invited to notice what different parts of our bodies are doing. Strange question, but if we are fully regulated, are we able to notice every single breath as it comes in and out? Or do we occasionally scan for different variables like our breath or contact with support, what our jaw is doing, etc.? Yeah, it's actually not that crazy a question. Valid. I think no. I mean, speaking from my own experience, I'm not just walking around noticing every single breath. That would be pretty exhausting. It's more the second one that you say here. So when we are in a place of regulation, we tend to just naturally be more connected to our environment and our experience. So that may mean that you, if the breath starts to do something that is not like within just healthy parasympathetic kind of flow, you would notice it really quick. Like you would notice, oh wow, I'm not breathing hardly, or oh, I'm breathing really fast. Okay, what's going on? So you're more connected to what your body is doing. That doesn't mean you're necessarily noticing all aspects of that at all times. You do have a greater ability to notice all those aspects, though. It's generally all a lot more available. And sometimes you may have a lot of what we call multitasking awareness going on. So, for example, I know for myself, something I've been working with for like the past 6 years is this tendency to stand on my left foot way more than my right foot. And it's something that I'm always in my awareness. I'm washing dishes, I'm chopping vegetables, I'm sitting at my desk, whatever it is I'm doing. If I start to lean on my left foot, I notice it and I'm like, nope, come back to the right leg, find your potent posture. And that's just something I'm always doing. And that is, I think, part of regulation is your ability to just be in that level of connection such that you can do somatic work throughout your day as part of your life. It's just how you live. So I hope that makes sense. And yeah, it's a pretty good thing. Being able to just, be more connected to your environment, more connected to your body's experience of your environment. That's what it's all about. I've been doing this work for 3.5 years. I've worked on a lot of developmental trauma. The last few weeks, the existential fears that I've already worked on many times have been surfacing again, much stronger now. Is it because I'm building more capacity? Anything I can do other than repeating nervous system exercises for early developmental trauma? Could be. So, yeah, it sounds like you have been doing that really good baseline work for supporting safety, growing capacity. So, yep, that is what tends to happen. As we grow capacity, we can feel things that we did feel before, but like, whoa, okay, now I'm really feeling it. Like, this is way more intense. Yeah, that is very common and probably what's going on. I can't say for sure. Maybe if there's something in your life that's different, that's triggering these existential fears, that could also be another reason. Apart from just something arising organically due to greater capacity. I mean, Lord knows world events could easily trigger existential fear. So if you're paying a lot of attention to that, or there's something that's really affecting you in the world right now because of where you live, like that could also be a potential reason. So I don't fully know. But if we eliminate those factors and your life is just kind of how it has been and kind of normal, and you have relative safety, then yeah, this is probably something that's happening because your capacity is getting bigger. So when you ask, is there anything I can do other than repeating the nervous system exercises for early developmental trauma? Possibly. And that would be just simply being present with the sensations of that intense existential fear and actually not doing anything to calm it down, not doing anything to soothe it, just staying present, feeling it in its intensity and staying connected to the environment and the very basics. Can I feel my butt on the chair? Am I breathing? Do I know? Can I see where I am? And that's it. And you just kind of let it happen. You let the fear come through. Now, at some point, there may be an instinct towards mobilization that may be helpful. Like maybe the legs want to run, or maybe you want to crawl into a corner and hide, or maybe you want to wrap up in a blanket. So you're sort of, that's how we tend to, or I tend to work with fear and support my clients. If we're working one-on-one, it's like if the capacity is there, Let's just hang out and feel this. Let's just be here and stay present. And if we need to, we're listening for any cues that may arise. Like, I want to, oh, I suddenly I want to do this. Do it. All right, great. So with any intense sympathetic charge, which is what we're talking about here, remember that, yeah, in order for it to really complete, it has to get to its peak threshold, which means feeling all the intensity of that fear and terror and dread while knowing that you're safe and seeing that you're safe and staying connected to your chair and your breath, etc. So, that speaking, another thing that may happen is your breath may change. Right? You may be realizing, oh wait, I'm controlling my breath. What if I don't control my breath? Oh, wants to be fast. And then you just let that happen. That may be part of letting that fear get to its threshold. So, all that being said, of course, it sounds like you're grounded in the practices for supporting capacity, soothing, settling, all that stuff. Definitely go to those if it starts to feel like too much. Because working with these layers of, really intense survival, fear, and terror, it's a lot. It absolutely can be done once you have the capacity to do it. But if it starts to feel like too much, you definitely have permission to, like, okay, that's enough of that. I'm gonna give myself permission to kind of pack this up, and I'm gonna distract myself, and I'm gonna go use my resources and get out of this experience. Totally fine. Hello, individualism has been on the rise, yet so many studies show that community is key to health. With early developmental trauma, this is an ongoing tension. How to prioritize? How does one build or maintain a strong network of support? So, yeah, with why this can be so paradoxical or difficult with early developmental trauma is when we have EDT, basically, we just sort of have people equal scary. Having a strong community could feel terrifying. So that's, yeah, a very valid point. I think that, well, one, overall, yes, community and social connection is important. Healthy community, healthy interaction is important. So not just any old, interaction. Like, we need to have healthy community, healthy interaction. And this is why, there's been this, not so much anymore, but in the 60s, 70s, this sort of utopian community paradigm thing that kind of happened where let's all go get on a piece of land and have our utopia. And of course, it always fell apart because no one was working on their trauma. And so what happened was instead of a lovely utopian community, everyone falls into their unresolved attachment wounds, familial dynamics, play that out with each other, and eventually everything explodes. So it's about healthy community, healthy connection. And one of the ways to help support that, especially if we have early developmental trauma, is to think about quality instead of quantity. We want to have good connections, even if that's just one. And that may not even be with a person at first. Maybe it's with our plants that we develop a really good relationship with and take care of and nurture. And that's good for us. It's good for them. That's a relationship. Maybe it's with a pet, maybe it's a low, super low maintenance pet, like a fish to start, or maybe it's a hamster. Maybe we have some pet that just like we can connect with and take care of, and we have a bit of that social engagement hit, and it's very safe. Or maybe we have one person, like a good friend, or maybe a family member, someone who's like, yeah, I don't have many people, but this person, I really, yeah, love them and feel safe with them. Great. That's more important than having a big community. It's about the quality of your community and your social connection. And then you can get a lot out of social connection through casual encounters. The nervous system, actually, believe it or not, can benefit from just really like casual interactions. The person who you pay for your latte, and you check out your get your groceries, and maybe you nod to someone on the street as you're walking by. Like, meaningless chit chat with your barber, like whatever it is, there can be a level that we get fed by these kind of really casual social interactions that don't have a lot of charge to them. That can actually be equally important. So that's how I would suggest you focus on forming that for yourself. There can be one other option, which can go one of two ways. Some people do get a lot out of online groups because there can be a safety in that barrier, that you're not physically with people. I have known a couple clients and students who have found supportive groups online that are interested in common things. At the same time, that can sort of go the other way if we're too much in just virtual connection, because we actually need real human connection in person, even if it's just with the grocery clerk. Like, we do need that. So it's important not to think that you can get all your needs met via social media or online chat groups and Zoom meetings and that kind of thing, because it can be part of it, but it's not the be all end all. So. Okay. I feel frustrated, shame, and disgust towards myself. I'm overweight with very large breasts, and I feel anger or despair when I don't lose weight or put on weight despite my efforts. I also have chronic pain and fatigue and feel the same when symptoms flare. I can be compassionate and loving to myself at times, but it's short-lived and sometimes feels fake. Other times I feel anger and despair and get stuck in it, like my body is against me, even though I always hear your body is working with you. How do I work on this? So I think it's important, probably first, just to understand and maybe normalize a couple things here. One, the inability to lose weight or the tendency to put on weight very easily is one of the most common experiences of nervous system dysregulation and unresolved trauma. It's actually how we got the ACE study, was by following a weight loss group. So this is totally normal for what you've experienced. So I don't know if that will help at all, but sometimes it does help to know that this is not unusual. This is a very normal struggle that you're experiencing. Another thing to think about is, you say, I feel like my body's against me. I always hear your body is working with me or with you. I think actually it's a partnership we need to develop with our body. I understand feeling like your body's against you, for sure. And when we're living with lots of survival energy, it can seem that way because we're having all these experiences in our body that don't feel good. And we're having these symptoms, right? Underneath that, I do believe that there is an inherent trend towards healing that the body has, that it organically does want to move towards or back into some kind of homeostasis and healthy balance. I think and have seen that that is an innate human drive, like part of our physiology. It wants to go towards wholeness. So in that respect, yeah, your body is working with you, but you have to work with your body also. It goes both ways. So it's really, rather than thinking about it like my body's against me or it's for me, it's like I'm in partnership with my body, which is me, and we're in this together, right? We're working on this together in partnership. I need to listen to my body and honor its needs. And that will be supportive in my body supporting me and moving together into wholeness and health. So, one of the things here in terms of working with this is you say, I feel anger and despair and I get stuck in it. And it sounds like that comes along with this shame, disgust, right? All of that is essentially internalized aggression. So that is, it's anger that's pointing inwards. It's shame and disgust that is not really yours. I'm gonna take a bet here that you were yourself toxically shamed as a young person growing up, that you experienced aggression in unhealthy ways, and because everything you're describing is what happens when we internalize toxic shame and aggression. So the key with that is to move out of the stuckness by starting to explore ways to mobilize these things, which of course the vu ah, the healthy aggression work, cultivating the inhale and the exhale. These are all lessons that can help with starting to get the system open and moving and expressing, following your impulse, right? What is the impulse that wants to come? And I think that starting to identify for yourself, who is this really about? Right? It's not really ultimately about you, because everything you're experiencing, it sounds to me, is the result of what happened to you. So who was involved with that? And how can you start to think about ways that this disgust, this anger, this aggression can actually start to be flipped and going that way in all the ways we talk about with the healthy aggression work, the annihilation work, etc. Like, who was it that actually hurt you in the first place, such that your system had to go into survival mode? And that's where the disgust and the blame and the shame and the anger, that is where that needs to go, as a way to direct it out of you so that it's not being held inside. Another point that is like outside of the scope of this work, but I've just experienced it a bunch, so I want to mention it. I have known a few women now at this point who had very large breasts, who got breast reduction surgery, and they were like, "This is the best thing I've ever done in my life for myself." It was super helpful for them. Totally outside of the scope of this work. But I'll just mention it because I have known many women who've done that who were really, really happy they did that. So that's just something that I've experienced. I don't know if that would be useful or not for you to explore, but it's something that I have heard. Anything about, no, that's it. And in terms of the weight loss, yeah, that's, it's something that it comes with time and regulation. It's something that I also struggled with a lot for many, many years. And now it's not an issue anymore. So it does resolve as our biological functions start to do what they're meant to do. Okay. I glue my tongue to the roof of my mouth at night, creating a vacuum. This is causing restricted breathing for me and a lot of tension in my face, palate, tongue, neck, and throat, probably down to my gut. Teeth and mouth trauma in childhood, and my eye muscles feel stuck somehow. I close my taste buds in the soft palate while eating, probably to manage my mom's cooking growing up. Can this be due to emotional bracing and trauma, and how can I work with the tension? So yes, it sounds like there is a lot of bracing and tension in your face and in the jaw, in the throat. And yeah, that generally speaking is the result of trauma. Any time we have are holding chronic tension in our body for a long time, that usually is because of trauma of some form. So how to work with it? It sounds like the themes are stuckness. And bracing. So, like, I would say play with mobilizing the face. Like, there's many ways to do that with your expressions, like make silly expressions. Ah, like move your jaw around. Ah, move the head around using the sounds, touching, holding the jaw, meeting the tension, like with an equal amount of pressure with your fingers, and then moving a bit, holding the face, working with the fascia of the face. That's another way. There's a playlist on YouTube that I actually have saved here which I'll put in the chat, which can be quite helpful for working with fascia in the face. It's from our friend and colleague Savannah, who that's her thing, is working with fascia. And this is all like self-guided stuff for working with the face. So that might be useful. One thing that's interesting is the part where you say, I glue my tongue to the roof of my mouth at night. So when we're breathing properly through the nose, we actually want our mouth, our tongue to be on the roof of our mouth. Now, glued sounds a little extreme, but we want our tongue to be resting against the roof of our mouth as we're breathing through our nose. That's actually the correct position for the tongue to support the best breath. So it sounds like your body is actually almost doing the right thing, but there's extra tension. There's this like a vacuum seal. So again, just playing with mobilization, like, stick your tongue out, right? Seeing yourself in the mirror doing these things, playing with, massage sounds, just all that stuff. And the eyes, working with exploratory orienting, deliberate orienting, doing things like eye differentiation work. That can sometimes be quite powerful. So that would mean like you hold your head still, but you move your eyes left and right. Or I move my head left with my eyes, but then my eyes stay left and my head comes back and then my eyes catch up. Or I move my eyes right and then I move my head to catch up with my eyes. Different ways in which the head and the eyes can move together and separately. That is another way to work with stuckness and tension. Just be aware that can also bring up some stuff because it can unlock, if there's tension in here, it's often reconnected to things we didn't want to see, that we had to see, or stuff that we didn't see that we should have seen, can be related to the visual information. So, all different things to consider exploring. Hello, in recent years, I've often heard the idea that a child is emotionally connected to their mother until the age of 7. In what sense is this true? I have a 5-year-old son, and at one point I was afraid to even feel any negative emotion because it seemed to me that every cold symptom he had was somehow my fault. Are a child's symptoms caused by the emotions that a mother feels? Thank you. So, lot to unpack in this question. So I'm going to do a little piece at a time. So first, the idea that a child is emotionally connected to their mother until the age of 7. That is a massive oversimplification. The child is emotionally connected to the mother to the degree that the mother is available for emotional connection. It has nothing to do with age at a certain level. It's like if the mother is showing up, open, co-regulating, doing all the right things, being in safety, all that stuff, then there'll be a deep emotional connection. There are, in stages of human development, different ages that are associated with different stages, but all of that can be totally variable depending on the nature of the relationship, the amount of trauma that mom and/or child have experienced. So those, even those developmental milestones may not always be accurate. Within a couple models, age 7 is one milestone, so that may be where you're hearing this from. But again, that is a massive oversimplification. Like, there's a degree to which we are always emotionally connected to our parents, even if we like don't ever see them. That bond, particularly with the mother through the umbilical connection, that I don't think ever goes away in my experience until the parent dies. So there's a lot of complexity to this. It's not so simple. We are emotionally connected to our parents in hopefully a way that is healthy. In a normal sort of regulated upbringing, I would say that there's one level of differentiation that happens around 2 or 3, where kids start to go away more from the parent and then come back. And they explore this whole dynamic of like, oh, I can go away from my secure attachment, but I can come back to my safe attachment and start playing with differentiation. They start saying no. There can be another level of maturity that does happen around 6 or 7, where there's a little bit more ability to understand the world in a logical sense, make sense of things. But again, all of that is dependent on the nature of the relationship and how much trauma is in the picture. So that's the first piece. Now, at one point, I was afraid to even feel any negative emotion. There's no such thing as negative emotions. You got to get that out of your vocabulary right away. Emotions are neutral by design. They are information about our environment and ourselves. That is it. There's no such thing as a bad emotion or negative emotion. What is negative is to hold and repress our emotions because we think they're bad or negative, because it is held and repressed emotions that create a lot of illness and disease in the body. Along with the survival energy that goes with it. So repressing an emotion because you think it's negative, it's the repression that is negative, not the emotion. So definitely get that idea of negative emotions out of your vocabulary. It's not accurate. Now, that can be confusing because we see negative or harmful expressions of emotion. It's not the emotion itself that's negative. It's if someone doesn't know how to handle it and they turn into a tantrumy toddler and start breaking things, that action is harmful. That action is negative, but it's not the emotion that's negative. Another thing, it seemed to me that every cold symptom he had was somehow my fault. Now, a child can feel sick because of a parent's emotional reality. Most often, again, that is because they are suppressing emotion. So children feel everything in their environment, whether spoken or not. So if a parent is repressing their anger and their disgust or whatever it is they're calling negative, then the child will feel that, and that can make them feel sick. They may have an upset stomach, for example, is one of the more common ones. But like, a child getting a cold may have nothing whatsoever to do with you, unless maybe they caught it from you, or like maybe there's a pathogen of some kind in the environment, or maybe there's some kind of toxin, or maybe there's mold, right? There's so many factors that can go into a child being unwell or anyone being unwell for that matter. But yeah, if we're repressing and holding all our emotions because we don't want to negatively impact our kid with what we think is negative, that could make them feel sick in their tummy or maybe in some other way. Now, there's one more piece here. Yeah. All that being said, that doesn't mean that we want to be completely emotionally open with our young children. So this is where there's some nuance to this. We may have to temporarily suppress a very intense emotion around our young children because to fully express it in the moment would be too scary for them. So, for example, if you're feeling intense rage or intense grief, something that feels very powerful, we don't want to just necessarily rah, let it out, do our healthy aggression work, twist the towel and stomp and rah. We don't want to do that around our young kids because that will be scary for them. So we may need to temporarily, I notice I'm feeling rage. I notice I'm feeling anger. Okay, I need to process that. I'm going to get away and go to the bathroom as soon as I can, and I'm going to twist the heck out of that towel and make some motions with my jaw and maybe a little bit of quiet sound, and then I'll come back. Like, we do want to protect our kids from big expressions of emotion, even if they're healthy expressions. Because what can happen is that it can be overwhelming for them, and then they may feel that they have to somehow be different so that we don't get so upset, right? They don't have the ability, especially if they're that young, to be differentiated fully. So once a kid gets to be preteen, teenager, then there can be more openness in allowing our emotions to be present in the present moment. So it's a complex, many-layered answer. I hope that all made sense. So let's take a little pause for a moment. So you can step away from the screen if you like. Go to the bathroom, get some water, move around, hop on one foot, whatever. So we'll be back in a few minutes. All right, welcome back. All right, continuing on. I have a very strong tension pattern in my neck. During sleep, I often press my head strongly to the right down into my pillow. I've tried to work with this and move with the tension, but nothing happens. Could this be a force vector lingering from a biking accident where the impact was on the left side, forcing the head to the right? And how can I work more specifically with it? I was also born with the umbilical cord around my neck and have spasms at the base of my skull and frequent headaches. Okay, so this could be a case like we were talking about with the trauma vortex of things being coupled. So the intensity of that survival charge that comes with having the umbilical cord around the neck at birth, which is extremely high, sense of distress. Could be part of coupled with perhaps this accident. That's possible. Again, do we have to figure it out? Not necessarily, but it could be an explanation for the intensity of what you're describing, if that was the case. But that doesn't, you don't really need to try to tease those apart necessarily, or know, but it's just something that might help inform what's happening. Now, with force vectors, what we mean by that is this is what happens when, say, a big hit to the body comes in and we get the support to fully process that in the moment or shortly afterwards. There can be this, what we call a force vector in the body, where it's like this energy is trying to move out the other side still. And that's possible. There also could be elements of incomplete self-protective response or procedural memory here. So I think there's a lot of ways that you can work with it specifically, such as with orienting, differentiation with the head and the eyes, like I was explaining a little bit ago. Doing all of that very deliberately, exploring movements, like pausing as soon as you feel tension, coming away from the tension, going a little further, coming back, bringing a sort of Feldenkraisian lens to it. But actually, I would suggest before getting into specific explorations like that, I'm getting the feeling it could be more useful to do explorations that involve more of the body. Sometimes when we have a very specific symptom in a place and we try to like really drill down in on that and like I just really want to work with this spot, it actually can be counterproductive in some ways. Because often there are elements of that tension pattern that are connected through the body, like through other systems, through fascial lines, through meridians, through muscular tension patterns. And we may need to actually resolve stuff in a more global way rather than only focusing on the neck or the head. So there's a few lessons in SBSM that I think could be interesting for you to explore, all of which, or most of which, are, I should say, Feldenkrais based. So those are Lab 7, Lesson 3, which is gentle head rolling, Lab 8, Lessons 1 and 2. That's mini balance the back and connecting the head and pelvis. Lab 9, which is rolling like a baby, that lesson. And also the watering the brainstem lesson in additional resources. Those are all Feldenkrais lessons that involve the head and neck, but also involve other areas of the body and noticing different types of movements as well. Gentle head rolling is more specific to the head and neck, but it also brings in noticing other places of support. So all of those could potentially be useful in working with this tension pattern. Another thing you can explore directly, though, is the force vector. So you could just sit with your head in a neutral position and just imagine, okay, so the force came in here and it would have want to exit here. and sort of hold in your mind that area of your body where the force wants to come out. And just sort of spend some time thinking about that area softening, becoming translucent, becoming thinner. Like there's there you can sort of open a door, a metaphorical door in the tissues. That's another thing to potentially explore. I've done some work like that myself, and it's been useful. And then, of course, the last thing is body work, manual body work. With tension patterns, it's not just enough often to get only body work to resolve it, especially if it's associated with traumatic events, but it can be a useful part of it as well. At some point, I would probably encourage you to do self-exploration first, in these various ways. But at some point, you want to check out, some form of Rolfing or osteopathy or Bowen or massage. Any of those could potentially be useful for just working with the tissues themselves. Second round of SPSM. I'm understanding how my nervous system has impacted my life and the decisions I took. And it's now, it's like I don't know who I am and what I really want. I'm still in high freeze, yet I have important decisions to make, especially for work, and that terrifies me. I'm afraid of making decisions that are not good for me, or to be influenced or forced by others, like the job administration. How can I make decisions as I'm still highly dysregulated and I don't trust myself anymore? Okay. And then there's another question that actually is very similar that I missed at first and didn't put them in a common theme. But that is, can you speak about navigating uncertainty or taking risks, especially in relation to career or career switching if one has early developmental trauma? There's advice about what to do in terms of career planning or testing ideas or roles, but what's the nervous system piece to this other hand? Of building capacity. Is it always about following capacity and not your desire? Can we know if something is a good fit going off by how we feel viscerally in reaction to a job description or an interview? So both questions are about I'm living with unresolved trauma still, and I'm trying to figure out the right decisions to make in my job, in my career. Do I go off of my felt sense and my bodily impulse? Is that the right way to navigate this? What do I do? For this first one, I just have to say, and this, you may not appreciate this, but when you say it's like I don't know who I am or what I really want, that's actually really an important stage, a very good sign in many ways, because that is something that always happens at a certain point along the journey of this work. Universally, I've seen, like, we get to a point where we've sort of let go enough of the old identifications and patterns that were associated with trauma and the ways of being and behaviors that were associated with trauma. And then we sort of like, well, who am I? Like, I don't really know. Like, I don't have this clear sense anymore because my personality and identity was shaped by adapting to trauma. And I've done enough work now that, like, that's kind of dissolved a bit, it sounds like. And it sounds like that's part of where you're at, which is actually a really important milestone. When you're in that place, it's a very important time to protect yourself and your space, I think. And so it's not the best time to make decisions about life and work, big decisions. I would say that approaching it logically rather than with your felt sense might be more useful in either of these cases. Just because if we're in a place of still working through early developmental trauma, or we're in this place of not really being sure of who we are, we can't necessarily always fully trust what our visceral reaction is. We certainly want to listen to it. So we always want to listen to our visceral reaction, our gut reaction. We always want to make room to hear it. We don't necessarily want to act on it immediately all the time, in this context. So I would say listen to your gut And also temper that with just logic. Like, what would best support my continued work right now? What best supports a sense of stability is probably pretty important right now. So, like, it probably isn't the time to make huge changes in your job or career or life. The system is in a place of vulnerability and being in process. And so as much as possible, we kind of want to pad that with predictability, sustainability, even if it's not like, woohoo, this is the most exciting job in the world, that maybe is not the most important thing right now. It may be more important to have something that is safe, relatively easy, predictable, you know how to do it. Maybe it's a little boring, but then you can show up, you're not, it's not tremendously stressful. And then you go and you're go do your work and you keep doing your work on yourself. That's probably how I would approach it. It's tough because, like, if you get a clear, like, say you're looking for jobs and you get a clear, like, gut hit of, like, oh, hell no. Yeah, you definitely want to notice that. It's just you want to spend time and look at it. Like, because that can happen from something that is potentially good, but is charged, right? Is maybe not the job I would go towards at that moment, but I would consider it. Like, for example, I had an opportunity recently to, there's a band I've been playing with, and we recorded an album, and then they wanted to do some shows. And like, my gut was like, oh, hell no, I don't want to do that anymore. Like, I used to do that back when I was in my college. I played tons of shows. I was a drummer, still am a drummer. But I kind of was over, like, I don't have that much interest in, like, going and playing shows and doing that whole thing. But, and my gut was like, no, like, don't do that. But I know enough about myself that logically I know, well, wait a second, what's that about? Because I can play drums, I'm good at it. I like it. This is an opportunity to do something that I haven't done for like 3 decades. It could be really interesting and rewarding. Am I just scared of this because I want to stay in my familiar routine? And that turned out to be true. Like, so my gut hit was not accurate in that case. And even from a place of regulation, because of all the different factors of, you know, my life and what I've been through and my need for predictability and safety, et cetera. So it was a good moment to challenge myself and not listen to my gut. So it can be kind of complex. And depending on where you're at, what you listen to can change. But I think that listening to your visceral impulses and then tempering it with like a logical kind of approach as to what objectively is going to support me would be the best way to approach this stuff. Okay. Hello, I believe I have early developmental trauma. Since I've been with my current partner, I felt a sensation of high arousal and fear that feels very new. It feels hollow in my gut. It's come up twice, seemingly randomly, once when he was playing guitar and during a heavy storm. Could this be an under or over coupling? I want to work with it when it comes up without going straight to the labeling or analyzing, like why is the arousal coming up, etc. Well, you got that right. Yeah, no need to overanalyze or try to figure out exactly what it is. Is this over or under coupling? Like, yeah, just let all that go. I believe that what's happening from what you say may indeed be related to early attachment wounds. If your new partner is someone that you feel very safe with and really good about, that can often open up a new layer of attachment wounding and survival stress in us that we may have been containing and guarded against. So that is possible, but the more important thing is just work directly with it when it happens. Like, you already are aware of what's happening in your body, you feel hollow in your gut. So, okay, great, there's your starting place. Feel the hollowness in your gut. Are you breathing? Can you notice where you are? Right? The basics. Can I orient and see my external world as I feel this hollow in my gut? Can I breathe? Okay. What happens now if I think about that diaphragm, if I think about that breathing diaphragm or my pelvic diaphragm? Can I bring in a little space around this feeling of hollowness? What happens when I do that? Is there some impulse that wants to come, etc.? Just doing the basics of somatic work directly as it arises. That being said, yeah, it's possible that this is related to just early attachment wounds and survival stress around safety in relationship. That is possible. Hello, I have early developmental trauma and have been doing this work for 3 years. Recently, I'm feeling way more, and I had to call my dad on the phone for something. It stirred up a lot of fear and emotion for me. I practiced containment, which brought on some tears, but was at a loss of what else I could do other than sit uncomfortably with my terror. Any advice on what I could practice next time I experience this? So actually, this is similar to a previous question in terms of what do I do with this intense fear? Again, really good milestone here. I'm feeling way more than I used to. Great. That means you are much less in freeze, and now you get to feel the really uncomfortable stuff. So that's unfortunately how it goes. The freeze lifts. A lot of people will say, I want my damn freeze back. It was so much more easy. Unfortunately, that comes with the chronic health problems. So, it does kind of suck that we get out of this freeze and then, oh wow, so now I have to feel all this stuff. Yep. And that includes the fear and the terror and the anger and the disgust and all that stuff. But we have to. That's the only way, is you got to feel it. And of course, we don't want it to be overwhelming also. So, what else could I do other than sit uncomfortably with my terror? Well, you could try to make it so you can sit more comfortably with your terror. That would be one thing to consider. So get a nice blanket, wrap it around you, bring in containment. It sounds like you did containment, which worked because then you weren't feeling only terror, you had some tears. Awesome. So you're already tapped into what the right thing to do is. You already got it. What are some other things you could do? Well, you could bring in your resources. You could bring in, cozy blankets, weighted pillows to squeeze or hold. Listen to your impulses. Sometimes with fear or terror, there is a mobilization that may want to happen. Again, we don't know exactly what that may be, but maybe the legs want to start to move a little bit or run, or maybe you want to curl up in a ball, or maybe you want to do something else. If you feel you have the capacity, you can also explore the idea of flipping the script of the terror. And this means, well, clearly this is about your dad who still really scares you. And what would happen if you feel the energy of that fear, but then you imagine using that energy to actually like stand up and like say no? And what if you were actually then to try doing that? And like, oh, I'm feeling all this energy of fear. Like, I'm going to put that into my legs and I'm going to stand up. I'm going to say no. Like, see what happens if you start to maybe find ways to channel the energy of the fear into anger, into something that's more proactive and about boundary setting, etc. That's another thing that you can do. It again requires a fair bit of capacity, but it sounds like you're doing well with growing that. So, yeah, all different ideas to explore. Ultimately, with all this stuff, it is ultimately about just feeling it and letting it move through. And it will happen. It's just we may need to do various things along the way to that point in the journey, such as titrating, resourcing, dipping in and out, pendulation, right? Mobilization, expression, all the different somatic tools. But yeah, oftentimes at the end of the day, when something really completes, it actually is kind of quiet. That's been my experience anyway, and that there can be something that was really intense and like shook your whole system, but now like there's more space in the system, and that same charge that before may have felt like, oh my God, it's just like this. And that's often when stuff actually truly resolves, in this sort of quiet, energetic way. It's like a lifting sensation. So it's not always crazy intense. It's just the process that's really intense seems to be making room for this stuff to happen. right? With all the various ways that we've packed it up and constricted around it and found ways to manage it with our behavior and our body. It's like that's the stuff that's really uncomfortable to change. Okay, last question. Can you please give us some guidelines and principles about how to know when it's time to see a body worker? And would you be willing to share about your own experience with painful body work? This question is arising because recently I heard a 74-year-old man talk about the amazing results he is getting from block therapy. However, the caveat is that he's willing to lean in and accept the pain. So that is just a reality of this work sometimes, not for everybody. For me, certainly, for Irene, certainly, we've both had lots and lots of body work because, especially Irene, just tons of injuries that happened to her while she was in freeze, and surgeries, just all sorts of impacts and falls and big, traumatic, painful things that happened while she was frozen. And now she's no longer frozen. And oh boy, like all those tissues need to get sometimes like they need the muscle needs to get ripped away from the bone because it gets glued to the bone. The fascia needs to get broken up manually. Like there's a lot of really painful body work she's had to do and that I've had to do to get our bodies back into flow. And yep, that can be part of it. How do you know when you're ready for it? You need to have the capacity to feel really intense sensations and emotions and be okay. Like when someone's not doing body work. So to really like, I can feel this twisting gnarl in my gut and I can be okay with that and I can sit with it and then I can allow it to express through my body and I can feel okay about that whole process. It's not overwhelming. If you can feel and express and be with really intense sensations and emotions, that's your cue that you're maybe ready to explore this kind of body work if you need it. What are some signs you might need it? It could be just tension patterns that no matter how much you work or express or mobilize or explore, they just don't go away. Or maybe they shift a little bit, but then they come back. Sometimes you just literally need someone to go in there and like rip that stuff up and break it up. Which really fucking hurts. So it's like, yeah. Safety is key. You have to feel safe with your practitioner. You have to be able to tell them to pause. So anytime you enter into body work of this nature, you need to feel one, even safe enough to have that discussion with a practitioner. If you don't get good vibes from them, go the other way. You need to have their, guarantee that, like, hey, I may need to ask you to stop and I'll need you to stop. I may need to make all sorts of moans and like different sounds. I might cry. I need all of that to be okay. And so any good body worker will of course be able to make space and accommodate all of that. And then if you want to get into this body work side of things, you can also gradate the intensity of the modality you're choosing to experience. So you might just start with relaxing massage and just see what that's like, just to get not even a deep tissue, just like a relaxing kind of massage. And then, or maybe you try Bowen therapy, which is quite non-invasive, and quite relaxing in my experience, but it works with the fascia and the nervous system. That's Bowen. Then, the more intense stuff is when you start getting into myofascial work, Rolfing, that kind of stuff. Neuropathic massage is another one I've heard of. These are all more involved with, like, yeah, unsticking the muscles from the bone, breaking up the fascial bracing patterns, that kind of stuff. But yeah, sometimes it's necessary. So, all right, that is it for today. Thank you all, as always, for being here. And thanks to my team, Jen and Susan, you're awesome. And thank you all. Yeah, really good to see you. And just, yeah, keep doing the work, keep showing up for yourselves. Really appreciate you being here. And we'll see you next week. Okay. Bye for now.